Now invite Brother Brian to come and speak to us to the title, That Seth of Cyrus, He is My Shepherd.
We very quickly went through verses 9 to 20 just as a gloss in the beginning of our class, because we didn't intend to spend a long time on that, which is really just an interesting story, the story of idolatry and its phenomenal folly. We did concentrate, however, on the first part of Isaiah chapter 44, verses 1 to 8. And especially on those final words, 6 to 8, where the prophet really asks the question, or Yahweh asks the question, is there a God beside me? Thus saith Yahweh, the King of Israel, and his Redeemer, Yahweh of hosts. Very formal and very noble terms of God's among God's names towards his people. He is Redeemer, he is Yahweh of hosts, he has strength to redeem, he's the first and the last, and beside him there is no other God. He is alone, singular, and all-powerful, without beginning, and able to do whatsoever he wishes. Is there therefore any need for anyone else? And who as I shall call and shall declare and set it in order for me, since I appointed the ancient people? And the things that are coming and shall come, let them show unto them. So the challenge went unto the nations, as it had in chapter 43. If they could produce an evidence of something being spoken of concerning the future, so that they had the light of the future years in their mind. And as in chapter 43, so in chapter 44, there is no a person that can take that up. Fear ye not, verse 8, neither be afraid. Have not I told thee from that time, and have declared it? And the passage behind that was the famous prophecy of Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 28 through to chapter 30, in which the history of Israel was given a chronological story form. And they were able to go back to that and say, well, did in fact that happen? Did this happen? Did that happen? It did happen. The good happened, the bad happened. It all happened exactly as God had said. And sitting in the middle of all of that evidence was the nation itself that had fulfilled the prophecy. Ye are even my witnesses, verse 8. Witnesses because, in fact, they had done exactly what God said. Witnesses because they had seen it. Ye are my witnesses. Is there a God beside me? Yea, there is no Zer. It's the word Zer, the word rock. The word of Deuteronomy 32, and that shows you, doesn't it, the exactitude of the prophet's comments. He was going back to the story in Deuteronomy chapter 28 to 30, and to that remarkable depiction of the future of the nation. And in chapter 32, he depicts himself as the Zer. And all through that chapter, remember last class? What were the perhaps 6 or 7 references to Yahweh as the Zer, the great mountain rock, the dependable power? All through that chapter was that depiction. Right through that chapter. It's the chapter of the Zer, Yahweh as the Zer. And so he says, is there a God beside me? Yea, there is no Zer, I know not any. And what was the contention in Deuteronomy 32? Why did he find fault with his people? Because they set up that which was no God's against him and provoked him to jealousy, for which cause he said, I will provoke you to jealousy by a no people. You provoke me to jealousy by a no God, I'll provoke you to jealousy by a no people. And that was the Gentiles, because they were a no people. They were not in God's economy at that stage, not related to his promises, no relationship to Abraham, no connection there with life and immortality. You know how the Apostle Paul picks that up, and he tells us what that means. Because he says that the incoming of the Gentiles has provoked Israel to jealousy, picking up the very words of Deuteronomy chapter 32. Well, in Isaiah chapter 44, the big next section was all about idolatry. Exactly the contention God had in Deuteronomy chapter 32. They that make graven image are all of them vanity, and the delectable things, the desirable things shall not profit. And they are their own witnesses. They see not nor know that they may be ashamed. That's powerful, my dear and sister. Did you notice the word witnesses again? It was there in verse 8, wasn't it? But in verse 8, because they had seen what God had promised, and they had seen what history had disclosed. And with equal power, there was another group of people, the vast percentage, unfortunately, of the nation, that had seen the folly of their own idolatry. They are their own witnesses. They're witnesses to the right, they're witnesses also to the evil of idolatry. Who hath formed a god or molten graven image that is profitable for nothing? Who has done that? Well, he said, they are, those that have done that are aware of the folly of their own pursuits. And he firstly deals with the two people that are involved in the making of idolatry. There's a sort of a teamwork. You see the hustle and bustle in verse 11. Behold, all his fellows shall be ashamed. And the workmen, they are of men. Let them all be gathered together. Let them stand up. Yet they shall fear and they shall be ashamed together. Together, together. It's teamwork. And that's, of course, what was involved in making of idols. They were very articulate and very ornamented. And there were all kinds of people that were involved with their different skills to make that a god of great embellishment. And so all his fellows, the workmen, are gathered together and they experience a common shame that they've worked on this lifeless object, and yet now they are their own witnesses that it has no power, no knowledge to save or redemption to offer. Then he speaks of the smith in verse 12, who works, of course, with metals, with the tongs, both worketh in the coals and fashioneth it with hammers. Worketh it with the strength of his arms. And you can see the satire of the prophet. What does a man have to use the strength of his arms to make a god? Isn't it God that gives strength to the arms of a man? Here's a man putting his tremendous strength, human strength, pitiable man, putting his human strength into making his god. And so the prophet makes folly of their exercises. Yeah, he is hungry, and his strength faileth. He drinketh no water, and is faint. So making the god, he becomes lacking in power. And he faints with lack of energy and drive. Is that the way to make a god? What about the object that finally you've made, that was made by mortal men, that grew faint upon hard work? What kind of a god, then, do they make? Or the carpenter, who stretched out his rule, marketh it out with a line, fitteth it with planes, and maketh it out with a compass, and maketh it out the figure of a man, according to the beauty of a man, that it may remain in the house. You know, the Apostle Paul speaks of exactly that, doesn't he, in Romans chapter 1. They have to make it after something. So they choose created creatures. In Romans chapter 1, verse 23, they change the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man. Corruptible man, that's exactly what Isaiah said. Into birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things. Verse 25, who changed the truth of God into a lie and worshipped and served the creature more than the Creator, who is blessed forever. A tragic and terrible blindness of men that has, of course, been a feature of all the pagan societies in the very earliest of times. And so in verses 14 to 17, the incredible stupidity of idolatry is portrayed in a remarkable section of the prophecy. There is the man who takes his cedar or his cypress or his oak, which he strengthened for himself among the trees of the forest. It was all his work, his work. He planted an ash. He was dependent on the rain that brought nourishment to it. Then shall it be for a man to burn, because he was cold, so he warmed himself with it. And then he was hungry, so he baked bread with it. Yea, he maketh the god and worshipeth it. he maketh a graven image and falleth down thereto. And the prophet goes on to ridicule the stupidity of this. He burneth part thereof in the fire. With part thereof he eateth flesh. He roasteth roasts and is satisfied. Yea, he warmeth himself and saith, aha, I am warm. I have seen the fire. Might have been the other way around. Instead of that third that became the god, it might have been that third that was made to bake his bread. Or to roast his roast. Or to warm himself. Oh, well, it was this third. So that became a god. And so in a most memorable manner, the prophet has depicted the utter stupidity of idol worship. And the residue thereof, verse 17, he maketh the god in his graven image. He falleth down unto it and worshipeth it and prayeth unto it and saith, deliver me, for thou art my God. Falleth down, worshipeth it, prayeth it, deliver me. Look at the complete adoration. Deep sense of worship. I mean, that is a folly if you could ever imagine something, isn't it? He has burnt two-thirds of it for common requirements in domestic life. And with the other, he falls down. He worships. He prays unto it and asks that it might deliver him. The divine reaction, verse 18, is to send blindness. They have not known nor understood, for he hath shut their eyes that they cannot see, and their hearts that they cannot understand. You know, that also is in Romans. Just quickly back to Romans 1 again. We looked at verse 23 and 25. Verse 24 is on that very note. In Romans 1, verse 24, wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness. He gave them up. They have not known nor understood, for he hath shut their eyes that they cannot see, and their hearts that they cannot understand. So verse 19 of Isaiah 44, and none considereth in his heart, neither is there knowledge nor understanding to say, I have burned part of it in the fire, yea also I have taken bread upon the coals thereof. I have roasted flesh and eaten it, and shall I make the residue, the remaining third, shall I make that an abomination of God? Shall I fall down to the stock of a tree? He feedeth on ashes. A deceived heart hath turned him aside, that he cannot deliver his soul, nor say, is there not a lie in my right hand? And so the prophet completes those famous verses 9 to 20. That would be the most extended dissertation that we have on the folly of idolatry, verses 9 to 20 in the scriptures. You might like to make a note there in Jeremiah chapter 10. There's also quite an extended section there, a very, very beautiful. In fact, just a quick reference there because of one lovely expression of God. In Jeremiah chapter 10, you'll see the context is very similar. It's a dirge against idol worship. And he says among those in verse 7, who would not fear thee, O King of nations? For to thee doth it appertain. For as much as among all the wise men of the nations and in all their kingdoms, there is none like unto thee. He is King of nations. And he shows that royal position because he's able to determine their future, and he stated their future in clear and unequivocal terms. He has stated the future, and so man should be able to see the vanity of what he's doing and the rightness of serving the King of nations. In his hands rests their control. You know, in Isaiah 44 and verse 20, he says, a deceived heart hath turned him aside. Now, if I asked any of you to go and worship an idol, you would say, look, don't be crazy. I'm not that stupid. Why is it that so many people have done that? I mean, there wouldn't be one of us that would even think for a moment to do that, would you? Why have so many people done it? If you went to India today, you would find that's the whole nation, are involved in idol worship. There are hundreds of different gods, crazy gods, eagle gods with elephant trunks on them, lion gods with eagle's wings on them, all sorts of crazy things, every combination you can think of. 900 million people, not all of them worshipping that, but by far the greatest majority of them. It's an amazing thing, isn't it? A country that says that has the second largest number of university graduates in the world, and yet they can worship that. How the hell do they do that? There's not a way in the world that you and I could do that. And as you think about that, you might think, well, you know, it belongs to paganism, but it belongs to Christianity. And the sad and tragic fact is that Isaiah 44 is not just related to the paganism of Canaan or the paganism of uncivilized nations, but to Europe itself, that is just reeking with idols. I mean reeking with idols. In Lithuania in particular, the Catholic churches there are just absolutely dripping with every kind of creature in front of your eyes. Unbelievable, my dear brothers and sisters. And the Orthodox are just as bad. This is the most amazing thing. It really is. Incredible thing. Men don't seem to be able, in the majority, to be able to relieve themselves from that wickedness and to come clean of all that. In Lithuania, you would see great pillars of people, and on the great pillars going up in the churches, in all kinds of figurines, all along the side of the churches, are these statues, paintings, and people coming before them and bowing and scraping before them. And they've been doing it for centuries of time. It was for that cause that God sent the Mohammedan plague upon the eastern side of the Christian world. In Revelation chapter 9, the abhorrence of God for the perpetuation in Christendom of a pantheon of gods, just as sickening, in fact more so than whatever was in Canaan and in Babylon of old and Egypt. In Revelation 9 and verse 20, and the rest of the men which were not killed by these plagues, yet repented not of the works of their hands, that they should not worship demons and idols of gold and silver and brass and stone and of wood, which neither can see nor hear nor walk, neither repented they of their murders, nor their sorceries, nor of their fornication, nor of their thefts. There it is. Christendom. That's what God thinks of all those huge, massive buildings full of idols. And that's what the people treat them as. They treat them as though they are power in itself. It's an astonishing thing. Despite all that we've got in Isaiah, despite what God has shown through Israel in all of the Old Testament. And along came the Lord Jesus Christ as the image of God. And what have they done? Filled up their buildings with everything but. And that's what they devote themselves to. So that if a man goes through that door, as I said last time, he'll be given repentance of all his sins. Plenary indulgences is the word. What would you have greater or worse in the idolatry of Canaan than you would have in a statement like that? Or everyone in that whole great city of Rome, everyone refers to the Pope as, you know, Holy Father, the Antichrist, the one that God absolutely despises, all of its system with it, the image which it has set up, which brings the worship of men. Astonishing thing, isn't it? Absolutely astonishing thing, but I suggest this, that if it wasn't for the scriptures, you and I would be hooked on something like that as well, with time. Because it's the inside of the scriptures that teaches you where you stand with that system. When you hear God say, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, can you think of a worse thing than that? And abominations in the earth, and full of the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. When you hear him say that, then you know where to stand, don't you? You really know where to stand. Come out of her, my people. So we're very thankful for the scriptures and never lose the grip of the prophets, which allows us to be able to see where God stands in all of those things. And we don't just drift in like, say, the Protestant churches. They once understood a lot of these things the same way as you and I. But because they've lost Daniel and lost Revelation and lost the sense of prophecy, they've just gradually assimilated until, well, you might say there's no Protestant church today. Even the Lutherans that first stood up, they're all one and the same parcel, really, with the Catholic Church, and increasingly so, doing things together and happy to have it that way. A deceived heart hath turned him aside that he cannot deliver his soul. So be thankful, my dear brethren and sisters and young people, for the power of the truth. And don't be lazy in our own minds. When you're at home and you've got time, don't be lazy. Pick up good things to read, good things. Don't let the world entertain us, but have our program whereby we are programming our own lives because of a conscience that's affected by our reading of the scriptures. We're not wasting time picking up this or picking up that because it just happens to be at hand. But we've got programmed lives. When I was away, I was impressed with that fact. You know, you can sit there just waiting for the next email all the time. Your life can be dictated from outside all the time with no program. We are people with program. We're going somewhere. We want to accomplish something every day of our lives because we're urged on by a conscience from the scriptures that our lives should be useful. So we move forward with positive mind, not always being sort of entertained by all the stuff that pours in from every direction. I think it's extremely important in every person's life. Don't go home to be programmed by outside, but have your own conscience toward God, whereby you are doing something every day in the interest of the truth. Otherwise this world will just sweep you along, and after a while you've accomplished nothing. And a day can go past. You've got nothing in your hand for it. Because everything's coming from outside. Advertisements and tantalizing things and entertainments. And it's just dictating the direction of our lives. And all these things that are precious and wonderful and interesting, exciting. Tonight's one of the most exciting studies you could ever have. Our study tonight. And it's important that we know it and that we learn it. And we make notes to understand it. Our young in particular make notes. And take it in so you in turn will be able to pass it on to other young people and inspire and thrill them with the veritable things that are written in the scriptures of truth that we can put our faith to. And that's how God thinks about it. All through this section tonight, all through, he's saying the test of my existence and of my royal position, of my claim to be God above all else, is that I've been able to tell are the things that are coming upon the earth. And you are witnesses. If he said that to Israel, how much more could he say that to you and I, that have seen far more than Israel ever imagined to see? So remember these, verse 21. Verses 21 to 25. Remember these things, it means, O Jacob. Remember these things, O Jacob and Israel. And by mentioning those two words, he does bring back, doesn't he, the very connections of where the people came to be God's people. It was through Jacob, to whom God gave another name, Israel. For thou art my servant. I have formed thee. Well, it's wonderful enough to be called God's servant. But it's even more wonderful to think that God has formed thee. Thou art my servant, he says again, O Israel. Thou shalt not be forgotten of me. For if God has gone to the trouble of forming Israel, will he now forget him? It's the same argument that you get in chapter 49. In chapter 49... and verse 14, but Zion said, Yahweh hath forsaken me, and my Lord hath not forgotten me, or rather hath forgotten me. Can a woman forget her sucking child, that she should not have compassion on the son of her womb? Yea, they may forget, yet will I not forget thee. Now, a woman wouldn't. But he said, even if a woman could, I wouldn't forget. I would never forget Israel. And just as the woman brings forth that child from her womb, God says, I have formed thee. Thou art my servant. He's put time and effort into that. Now, there's a little expression that Job uses. Very touching, very similar. It's in Job 14. He says that in the day of resurrection, God will call him because he will have respect to the work of his hands. It's in Job 14, verse 15. Thou shalt call, and I will answer thee. Thou would have a desire to the work of thine hands. Isn't that lovely? In other words, God did a work with us. Here we were at Brighton, working together as a team. And we were called from all different parts of life, and our mothers and fathers, our grandparents. All these things have happened, haven't they? And here we are together. God's working with us, and we feel that. And Job says he won't forget that. See, it's not just us in the team, is it? It's not just us working. God's there. And therefore he wants us in the kingdom. Fear not, little flock. It is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. So, I have formed thee. Thou shalt not be forgotten of me. And then in verse 22, it sort of springs off the page. I have blotted out as a thick cloud. You can't see through a thick cloud. Thy transgressions. They're gone. Look for them. All you see is the black cloud. And the transgressions that were there are gone. And as a cloud, thy sins. Return unto me, for I have redeemed thee. They are beautiful words, my dear brothers and sisters. That's what man needs. Of all the things that we need, that's what we need. Forgiveness of sins. Then we can come before God. It is your sins that have separated you from your God, says the prophet in the 59th chapter in verse 2. Take away the sins and redemption comes, doesn't it? That's the barrier. And God, in a stroke, says, I have blotted out those as a thick cloud thy transgressions. Thy sins are clouded. Completely obscured. What a beautiful state. And so there is redemption. If God takes away our sins, we have redemption. Ephesians chapter 1 puts it exactly the same way. It equilibrates the forgiveness of sins and redemption. Verse 7. In whom we have redemption through his blood. What's redemption? The forgiveness of sins according to the riches of his grace. When you think about it, that's true, isn't it? Everything else follows. If those sins have been taken away, that might otherwise obscure us from our God. This is man's greatest need then, and God, verse 22, has provided for it. And if you're listening to Isaiah, you may say to him, Where has he done that? You mean the Day of Atonement? How has he done that? It comes every year. It comes back every year, which means there must be more sins. But this statement is an eclipsing statement, isn't it? A statement of finality. It was very similar, of course, to what he wrote in chapter 43, verse 25. I am he that blotteth out thy transgressions for mine own sake and will not remember thy sins. What more do you need, Israel? Where have I failed you? Why will I forget you, saying I've provided for everything? But the real answer to the questions of verse 22 is going to come, isn't it? In the 53rd chapter. In the 53rd chapter it's going to be made plain what has been hinted to before in the prophecy, but in the 53rd chapter he will say this: he was wounded for our transgressions, bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. That's in the prophecy too, and that's the answer. When he says, I have blotted out as a thick cloud thy transgressions, there is how he has done it, the means by which he will bring that redemption. And the 53rd chapter will expand that and bring it home. Well, if that's the case, then who's going to be grovelling at the feet of idols? Who's going to be in all the uncertainty of that vain worship where in fact you never really answer your mind, you never really look to your mind and your conscience. Who could ever be satisfied in conscience before idolatry? But if God has done this, verse 22, and brought us near to him, and he wants us, he will not forget us, then verse 23, sing, O ye heavens. There should be a response, because everything's open to us. For Yahweh hath done it. It's finished. Well, of course, it wasn't really. It was yet to come, but in his mind it had, calling those things which be not as though they were. Therefore sing in that power of redemption that God has provided. Sing, O ye heavens, for Yahweh hath done it. Shout, ye lower parts of the earth, from the heights of mankind to the depths, from the great to the small, it is open to all. Break forth into singing, ye mountains, O forest and every tree therein. He's not talking about the literal mountains. They don't sing, do they? But the peoples that live in those parts, and these things as symbols of all mankind in their different ways. O forest, large collections of people, and down to every tree therein, the little individual a person that may feel that they've been forgotten. From top to bottom, from great to small, from large companies to individuals, Yahweh hath redeemed Jacob and glorified himself in Israel. Isn't that lovely? You see the flow of thought? God's provided all we need. Need redemption? Then we need forgiveness of sins. And God has gone ahead and provided it for us. Thus saith Yahweh, verse 24. Thus saith Yahweh, thy Redeemer. Repeating it again. Who is he? Who else is he? He that formed thee from the womb. Picking up the expression of verse 21 again. I am Yahweh that maketh all things, that stretcheth forth the heavens alone, that spreadeth abroad the earth by myself. Can you need a greater God than that? Is there any limitations to his power? He has everything there that man could possibly be wanting as the guarantee of salvation. He said similarly in chapter 42, verse 5. Chapter 42, verse 5, he similarly described himself. 42:5, thus saith El Yahweh, strength. Yahweh, he that created the heavens and stretched them out, he that spread forth the earth and that which cometh out of it. Now there he's saying that because his salvation is going to be universal for all people. See verse 6, a covenant of people, a light to the Gentiles. So they are expressions of a universal God that has a universal opportunity for mankind that's not inhibited as to place or people or civilization, but a universal God that can stretch out the heavens. Therefore there is none too certainly. And verse 25, that frustrateth the tokens of the liars, the omens of the liars. That is the statements of the idols, the oracles as they call them in history, where they have a collection of idols, and it would be known as an oracle, for where a man would go to get a word from God, and the priest would eventually come up with this statement as though it came from the God himself, you see. And so they were called oracles. And God says he frustrates the omens of the liars, because that's all they are. They know not the future. They make up a story. And God says, I frustrate that story. And you know, that's wonderfully true, isn't it? He frustrates the omens of the liars and maketh diviners mad. Can you think of an example that was coming up? Where's the prophet going? Where's he driving with this? What's the line of his thought? That turneth wise men backward and maketh their knowledge foolish. We're going to see that, aren't we? Not so long off in history. Where are we going to see it? We'll see it in Daniel, won't we? That frustrateth the omens of liars, maketh diviners mad. So all the wise men of Babylon were made to look foolish because they were not able to tell the king. That turneth wise men backward and maketh their knowledge foolish. In chapter 47 and verse 12, speaking of Babylon again, he says, stand now, verse 12, with thine enchantments, Babylon, harlot city, stand thou with thine enchantments and with the multitude of thy sorceries, wherein thou hast laboured from thy youth. If so be thou shalt be able to profit, if so be thou mayest prevail. Thou art wearied in the multitude of thy counsels. Let now the astrologers, the stargazers, the monthly prognosticators stand up and save thee from these things that shall come upon thee. He frustrates the omens of the liars. And they were, to a very real degree, concentrated in Babylon. Babylon had become the centre of idolatry. Because what Babylon did, Nebuchadnezzar did this first, when he went to all these different countries, he would take the god of that country and he would bring that to Babylon, the god of this country and the god of that country. So eventually in Babylon you had all the gods, all the nations. And he felt, having honoured them therefore in his capital city, he had all the gods on his side, he couldn't go wrong. In actual fact, he never worshipped them. He was almost a monotheist. Not the right theos, not the right god, but he almost singularly worshipped Merodach. And history records that. But nevertheless, he brought all the other gods, I suppose, just to have them all on your side within the city of Babylon. So they became a phenomenon. You could go to Babylon and there was a whole pantheon of heathen gods in that city. And so he says, I'm going to frustrate them. And their oracles are going to come to naught, and those priests and those wise men that hover about those places, they will be shown to be madmen and without knowledge. But where is the prophet going? He says in verse 26, that confirmeth the word of his servant. He frustrates the others, verse 25. He confirms the word of his servant, that is the prophet. The prophet of Israel, and performeth the counsel of his messengers. Where's he going? That saith to Jerusalem, thou shalt be inhabited, and to the cities of Judah, ye shall be built, and I will raise up the decayed places thereof. Now, my dear brothers and sisters, when they heard Isaiah say that, they may have said to themselves, well, of what does this prophet speak? Is the temple? Is the king's palaces? Is the walls? Is all the people's houses? Of whom does he speak? Judah's being inhabited. We're in the latter part of Hezekiah's reign. It's prosperous. Nations are coming to see Jerusalem. Even the people of Babylon have come to see Jerusalem. They're interested in our remarkable king. But what does Isaiah speak about? What the word must mean is that Jerusalem was not going to be inhabited. There's going to come a time through invasion in which it would not be inhabited, and then it would go back to habitation. And to the cities of Judah, ye shall be built, must mean that there's going to come a time when the cities of Judah will be lost again. They have been recently lost in the days of Sennacherib when he came through the land. But the sense of the prophecy must mean that they will be lost again and Jerusalem will be raised again and the place will become desolate places again, and then it would return again to a flourishing habitation. When? Of what does the prophet speak? Where's he going? There is obviously a matter in the divine mind, and he's obviously driving in that direction. As he builds up in sort of crescendo, you can feel it. And then he says, verse 27, that saith to the deep, be dry, and I will dry up thy rivers. Now, normally speaking, the person in Israel would think to himself, well, that's the Red Sea. And Isaiah has used the Red Sea as exemplary of God's deliverance for his people in other places already. Quite often, in fact, like chapter 46 and verse 9. remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is none else. The former things. In chapter 10, in other places, he refers to what he did to deliver Israel from Egypt. Is this then, verse 27, a reference again to the Dead Sea that saith to the deep, be dry, and I will dry up thy rivers? Well, why then does he say in verse 28, that saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd and shall perform all my pleasure? Who's Cyrus? And it must have been a great complexity to people who heard the prophet issuing this statement in those times. Who is Cyrus? And what's more, Cyrus is denoted as making some remarkable statements in favour of Israel. He shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built, and to the temple, thy foundation shall be laid. Which must mean, when he said in verse 26 that Jerusalem was going to be a place inhabited, that the temple also was going to be destroyed, because it's going to be rebuilt in this rebuilding of Jerusalem, when the cities are re-inhabited and so on. Cyrus is going to be involved. Who's this Cyrus? Now, my dear brothers, isn't the word of God absolutely amazing? Just for your interest, there are people that see this is so wonderful that they can't believe it. It's almost because it is so wonderful that people have come to say, well, this must be said in the time of Cyrus the Great. Otherwise, people wouldn't know what he was talking about. But there was a time when God spoke of Josiah, didn't he? There will come a man, Josiah by name, in 1 Kings chapter 13. And that was hundreds of years before Josiah came by name. But the prophecy waited and it was fulfilled exactly. Did that discredit that prophecy because God had said the very word of the king who would do that? The prophecy not detracts from it. And if people in the day of Isaiah would have said, well, who is Cyrus, and talked among themselves, well, perhaps it means what the word means. There's all sorts of thoughts as to what Cyrus actually means, because it's a Persian word. Perhaps we could be happy to accept the understanding that it means he who is like the air. Like the air, H-E-I-R. Because he is like the air. In many ways, he becomes a type, strangely, of the Lord Jesus Christ, remarkably. So when we put those verses 26 to 28 together, we can see where they're going now, can't we? This is talking, in verse 27, not about the Red Sea, but about the river Euphrates. For it was the river Euphrates that Cyrus used to come into the great city of Babylon after Babylon had conquered Judah and its countryside and left it desolate. After that, Cyrus came in the 70th year of Babylonian ascendancy, and he made declaration that that city was going to be rebuilt and that the temple should be, in fact, rebuilt. Now, just verse 27, just look at the language of it. It's a river that's being dried up. And you have a very similar statement to that in Jeremiah chapter 50, of the same incident. Jeremiah chapter 50, verse 38. Thrilling things. Jeremiah's down the track, of course, from Isaiah, but this is what he says. Concerning Babylon, a drought is upon her waters, and they shall be dried up, for it is the land of graven images, and they are mad upon their idols. See that? Why is the judgment coming? Because of the idols. And that's what Isaiah is speaking about as well. Chapter 51, verse 32. For if judgment came upon Israel because they took the idols of the nations, why would not the nations too suffer judgment for the same cause? Jeremiah 51 and verse 32. And that the passages are stopped, and the reeds they have burned with fire, and the men of war are affrighted. There are passages, you see, dealing with the waters of Babylon, speaking of them receding. Babylon was famous for her waters, for the great river Euphrates came right through the city. Just diagrammatically, it was something like this. Just diagrammatically, we imagine that the city, the river Euphrates came through the city like that. That's very diagrammatic, I might say. But as it went through, the Babylonians, this vast city, that some people think was 15 miles by 15 miles wide, as it went through, it had, of course, gates here. There were roads and there were canals. The roads and there were canals. And the canals allowed the waters of the Euphrates to go to the furthest suburbs of Babylon. You know, it might have been out there. But people could be working out here in whatever particular materials they were making, and they could put them onto their little vessels, and they could take them down here, and put them on the river Euphrates, and out to the Persian Gulf, and on the markets of the world, see? So Babylon was well situated for that. And there were also pathways or roads that came down to the river. But so that the city would be safe, because it has to go under the wall of the city here, doesn't it? And there were gates that were placed over these accesses to the river. There were gates there which, after some steps, prevented people from coming into the city from the river after a certain time. The rule was that they should be shut by night. That was a feature of the city of Babylon. Given that, then, the water was a wonderful asset to them. In time of siege, they could sit there, they could sit back. When Cyrus came, they said, "We've got 5 years' supply. Who could stand out there for 5 years and defeat us? We've got no way." And once more, they grew tremendous quantities within the confines of their own city as well. So, what Cyrus in fact did when he came to the city, and he could see that he could not prevail against it, in fact he had tried it some time, he decided to lay here a certain number of his soldiers and a certain number on that side as well, right? It didn't make it easy for them just to scour about as they might like. And then he went off up the river here further, and because he had seen what an earlier queen had done to the river, he decided to do something of the same kind. Oh, I've lost my mark. Where are we? Page 97 is right. Cyrus was now reduced to great perplexity as time went on, and he made no progress against the place. This is from the historian Herodotus. It's quite a simple description. In this distress, either someone made the suggestion to him, or he bethought it himself of a plan, which he proceeded to put into execution. He placed a portion of his army at the point where the river enters the city, and another body at the back of the place where it issues forth, with orders to march into the town by the bed of the stream as soon as the water became shallow enough. In other words, he's going to take off a certain portion of the river, he's going to direct it into other ways, and when he's ready, he will let that sudden influx of water drift off into these other areas. The water, therefore, in the river will drop. It won't, of course, dry up completely, but it will be sufficient to allow the body of men who are here or there to be able to slip through under the gates that otherwise would preclude them when the water was at its height. He then drew himself off with the unwarlike portion of his host and made for the place where Nitocris, that was the queen of earlier time, had dug the basin for the river, where he did exactly what she had done formerly. He turned the Euphrates by a canal into the basin, which was then a marsh, on which the river sank to such an extent that the natural bed of the stream became fordable. Hereupon the Persians, who had been left for the purpose at Babylon by the riverside, entered the stream, which had now sunk so as to reach about midway up a man's thigh, and thus got into the town. However, had the Babylonians been apprised of what Cyrus was about, or had they noticed their danger, they would never have allowed the Persians to enter the city, but would have destroyed them utterly, for they would have made fast all the street gates which gave upon the river, that is, they came down to the river, and mounting upon the walls along both sides of the stream, which would have so caught the enemy as it were in a trap, because now they would have been inside the city, and they closed the shop of Babylonians and got them, haven't they? Because they can't go in. But you see, the gates were open. A mistake had been made. But as it was, the Persians came upon them by surprise and so took the city. Owing to the vast size of the place, the inhabitants of the central parts, as the residents of Babylon declare, long after the outer portions of the town were taken, knew nothing of what had chanced. But as they were engaged in a festival, is that ringing bells? Is it writing words on the wall? Continued dancing and reveling until they learnt the capture, but two senses of the first taking of Babylon. Well, that's the most intriguing comment that Herodotus has, and it fits in perfectly with the little inferences that we have here in verse 27. And again in chapter 45, verse 1, because there it says, "That saith, thus saith Yahweh to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden, to subdue nations before him, and I will loose the loins of kings to open before him the two leaved gates, and the gates shall not be shut as they should every night have been. And I will go before thee and make the crooked, the difficult places, I will make them straight. I will break in pieces the gates of brass and cut in sunder the bars of iron." And there was 176, I think, of these gates along the river. "I will break in pieces the gates of brass and cut in sunder the bars of iron." Well, they weren't, of course, cut in sunder, but the key was in the door, so to speak, and through the Persians came, and so they were able to take the city. And what God is saying in verse 2 is that something might seem humanly impossible to even a great conqueror like Cyrus is going to be made possible because I'm with him. And I'm going to see that he will be able to do what I intend. Now in chapter 41, there was an earlier statement in which that very sense was portrayed. God was working with this man Cyrus in a most incredibly wonderful way. It says in chapter 41, "Who raised up the righteous man from the east?" Now notice that. The righteous man from the east. This is talking of Cyrus. And you say to me, a heathen king, righteous? That's how he's gone down in history. There is a tape that was played at Persepolis, which is the ancient capital, ceremonial capital of the Persian kings. And when visitors went there, they would hear this tape broadcast. And he was described as Cyrus, the righteous one. That's how he was known among his people, among the nations of that time. The Jews loved him. Wherever he went, he endeavoured to resuscitate kingdoms, to lift them up and to give them a position where their economy would work and they could be part of his great empire, rather than to crush them and drag out all the good of that nation so that in fact its economy would be broken and therefore less value to him. And what's more, there would be resentment. He wanted to reign because people would see in his government justice and decency. Now, isn't that an incredibly interesting thing, my dear brothers and sisters? Look what you're looking at. Who raised up the righteous man from the east, a heathen king, called him to his foot. "Come on, Cyrus, come to my foot." In other words, God is going before him. The angels are going to make things easy for this amazing man. Gave the nations before him and made him ruler over kings. He gave them as dust to his sword and as driven stubble to his bow. What an amazing statement. In other words, everything's going to go right for this amazing man. And that is exactly what happened. He came upon the world like lightning. Everything crushed in front of him. He came up to Media, which was sort of related to him, and his wife was a Median, Mandane. He had married into that family, and the soldiers and people of that of the Median area, they wanted him. But they accepted him immediately. When they said, oh, he's going to be the one that will be the commander of the general of the army, oh, in they went immediately, were rejoiced to go with him. And off he went to Assyria, and he cleaned all the Assyrian area up. And then he went on to the area of Lydia, which is sort of western Turkey. And there was a king there called King Croesus, an extremely wealthy man. Extremely wealthy. And, you know, he owned the local gold mines. Wouldn't be too bad, would it, to personally own the local gold mines. Extremely wealthy man. And he wondered whether, in fact, he would attack, because he was worried about Cyrus coming from the... Who is this Cyrus that came from the east, you see? And so he crossed the river Halys, sort of half divides the area of Turkey. And he crossed it because he consulted the oracles all around the world, Delphi and Olympus and all those others. And he got the message back from Olympus which said, in the day that you cross the river and attack, there will be a great empire destroyed. He took that to mean a positive note to himself. But in fact, it could have meant just the opposite. It was a two-way thing. Anybody could say it, really. But in his pride, he accepted that, crossed the river, and Cyrus swept him out of existence. And then he continued right through his area of western Turkey, and he came to Sardis, which was his capital of Croesus, and he took the kingdom of Lydia. And the only thing then that was left, of course, really, of consequence, was Babylon. But Babylon was sort of back east now and under. And so he came back that way and came down into that area from what we would call Turkey, and he came up... by way of the area between the two rivers, Mesopotamia, between the rivers. There was the Tigris and there was the Euphrates. And so he advanced to the city of Babylon. Everything went his way. And history records, you know, just how amazing it was. He took the city of Sardis that everybody thought was impenetrable. And yet he took it. He took it easily. Which, of course, we've learned in our Revelation studies, haven't we? Revelation chapter 3. Isn't the Bible wonderful? It's an electrifying material, isn't it? You won't find anything like that anywhere else in the world. I wish the whole world knew it, don't you? Here we are, just our little group, and we understand that. They're wonderful things, beautiful things. Wish the whole world would take notice of those things, don't you? And be able to see that there is a living God that's in full control of everything. Just as much today as he ever was in these days. He wrote this 130 years before Cyrus ever came into existence. And it's so wonderful that stupid man has gone and said, well, it must be written after. And what power would it have then? Who would listen to a word of it after the thing had already happened? Be powerless, be useless indeed. A second to Isaiah. What a lot of nonsense that must be. It's powerful because it's said in a context, a very, very context, where God is saying time and time and time again all through this section, I am God because I tell the future. I am God because I tell the future. You have my witnesses. You are my witnesses of things that I have said and the things that I've done. And in the context of that, set in that garden, is this beautiful statement, this peculiar statement of a man called Cyrus who would do these things. You know, it says that he would loose the loins of kings. Did you see that in verse 1? Do you remember, my dear brothers and sisters, just have a look at this, in Daniel chapter 5, because this is the night it happened. In Daniel chapter 5 and verse 6, this is what Daniel records. In the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Then the king's countenance was changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his loins were loosed, and his knees smote one upon another. Now look at that reference. You don't believe the Bible? You know, what a powerful thing that is. A little detail that was just dropped in there by the prophet Isaiah. In all the great things that he was doing, he says that when that happens, that even the kings of Babylon, their loins will be shaking because of the fear that's come upon them. There they were in all their smug pride, sitting as the queen of the nations. I sit a queen and am no widow, it says in chapter 46 of Isaiah. Yes, when the writing went up on the wall, they were shaking like a man. And that's exactly what Isaiah had said. You know, there's more than one prophecy like that in Isaiah. Quickly come back to the 13th chapter. About the same thing it is. Three times Isaiah mentions that feature. In chapter 13, the Medes, which of course were with the Persians, it says in verse 6, How ye, for the day of Yahweh is at hand, it shall come as a destruction from the Almighty. Therefore shall all hands be faint, and every man's heart shall melt, and they shall be afraid. Going pangs and sorrow shall take hold of them. They shall be in pain as a woman that travaileth. They shall be amazed one at another. Their faces shall be as flames. What about that? That's exactly what happened in that revelry with 1,000 princes. And they took out the golden vessels of the temple of Jerusalem, and up went the writing, and the place was turned into chaos of fear. And that's what Isaiah said. They were smug until it happened. And when it came, they were affrighted. In the 21st chapter of Isaiah. Again, this is about the coming of the Medes and Persians against Babylon, and it says, as the prophet feels all the impact, see verse 9, Babylon is fallen, and all the graven images of her gods he hath broken unto the ground. But when the prophet saw that, this is what he said in verse 4, my heart panted, fearfulness affrighted me, the night of my pleasure hath he turned into fear unto me, the night of my pleasure. And Herodotus comes along, who was a prophet, who was a historian sometime after, not that long after, and he gives a record which is exactly that. They were engaged in festival, continued dancing and reveling until they learnt the captivity was upon them. That's exactly what Isaiah said. They will be caught in all their revelry. There they were having a grand time, and God's word caught up with them because they had taken no notice of it. So there's another little aspect of it that is remarkable. Now the other thing that I wanted to just dwell upon for a couple of minutes, which will be the final comment, it does say in chapter 44 verse 28 that he's going to give a command that Jerusalem will be built and the temple that its foundation shall be laid. Now you know that he did do that, don't you? And it tells us that twice in the Bible, doesn't it? At the end of the book of Chronicles, 2 Chronicles 36, it tells us that. Verse 23. Thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth. You know, you could weep with a statement like this, my dear brothers, just in the light of what we've read tonight and felt the feelings of God involved in these things, the king of nations, eh? Now Cyrus is saying it himself. The man that's had all the nations swept before him like dust they moved when he came. And this is what he says. All the kingdoms of the earth hath Yahweh, Elohim of heaven, given me. Isn't that a beautiful statement? Isn't that a thrilling passage of your Bible? That's Cyrus. He's brought from the height of his military conquests. People were mesmerized by his adroitness and his astuteness in governing peoples. But he's come to see that there was a God in heaven who was controlling him and giving it to him. And he hath charged me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Right, he says, we're going to do it. Who is there, therefore, among you of all his people? Yahweh his God be with him, and let him go up. And Ezra, in his opening words, says the same thing. In fact, he says it was in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of Yahweh by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled. Yahweh stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and put it also in writing. Thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, Yahweh Elohim of heaven hath given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he hath charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Where did he get that information from, my dear brothers and sisters? It's almost the very words that you had in chapter 44 and verse 28. And how do you think it might have happened? Well, I don't know exactly how it happened. But just for a moment, picture this. There's the banqueting hall, and the king is Belshazzar. His father is Nabonidus. They're co-rulers, but Nabonidus is not there. Nabonidus liked to be out in the field somewhere. That's the type of man he was. Belshazzar liked to be governor. So the son was left back on the throne. Dad was round, roaming around. The writing goes on the wall. And they, at the end, brought in the old man. Daniel came in. And they asked him to interpret the meaning of the words to him. And they knew that he had the ability to do that because Grandpa Nebuchadnezzar had been helped mightily by that man. And that stupid young generation had neglected that great man who was in their midst. And yet Grandpa had looked to him and had learnt wisdom and made him the head of all his wise men. But now he's in obscurity. In the last hour, with the golden vessels now on the table and the writing on the wall, and their loins trembling with fear, they bring the old man in. How old is he? He must be in his late 80s. If he was 70 when he came in, now he's 87. He may have been older. And he must have been a sight to see as he came in and told them in a beautiful, beautiful characteristics that he had. Calm, faithful manner, the gentle and gracious man of God. And he told them in no unmistakable terms what that meant. Your kingdom is divided and taken from you. And that night, says Daniel chapter 5, the Persians took the city and Belshazzar was slain. And who's in control? The promise was that the one who interpreted that would be given a gold chain and made third ruler in the kingdom. Nabonidus is number one. Belshazzar is number two. Who's number three? Daniel. Out of absolute obscurity, in his old age, that man is made the third ruler in the kingdom of Babylon. My dear brothers and sisters, if you were a Jew looking through the door and saw that, how would you feel? Hey, what an incredible thing to see. That God, throughout all that was happening, and all the mad revelry and idolatry of that crazy place, and you loved the hope of Israel and all it stood for, and all of a sudden, Daniel's called in this crucial hour, and all around are the Persians, and they couldn't care a hang about that, they're having a feast. And this old man that you love, and that God was clearly with, and that Babylonians had seen that God was with him before, they bring him in, and he stands before them. And he tells them. And in come the Persians. And then, of course, there's a handover of the city. As there is in any conquest, there's a proper and formal handover. And the representative of the local people comes forth and meets the invading general, or the king, who it might be. And there is a formal handing over. Who handed over Babylon? Not Belshazzar. And Nabonidus was out to boot. Don't know where he was. That city, in all likelihood, was handed over by the old grey man who had the golden chain around his neck. And it would have been an incredible balance that the man, in fact, who had told the history of Babylon should be the one who should hand that city over to the man that God had chosen, the righteous man from the east. And it wouldn't be many minutes, surely, certainly within a few hours, that he'd say, look, what did you say your name was? But you're not, how come you're in control here? Because of the writing. What writing? Why did they call you? Who's Nebuchadnezzar? You mean his grandfather? Yes. What happened then? Well, he had a dream too. And all that story will be told. And wouldn't you listen to Daniel in those circumstances? Any wise man would listen. And these books here of Roland are full of the wisdom that Cyrus had. He would have sat down with that man and said, I want you to tell me what's going on here. And he would have told him in the most wonderful way of all that God had wrought. And I am certain, what would you do If you had an interested friend with a situation like that, eventually you get to the time when the background was right and you pull out Isaiah chapter 44 and say, there's your name. Wouldn't you? Of course you would. And you'd say, there you are again. God's anointed you for the purpose. And you've got a destiny. What is that destiny? Old man. Remarkable old man. Your destiny is to rebuild Jerusalem, and you're going to give the decree. And in the first year he did. In the first year of Cyrus. And he gave that with such deliberate determination that it was done. He roused the Jews for that. What an incredible thing, my dear brothers and sisters. What a wonderful thing. That is a wonderful prophecy. And because of that, we can have faith in our Bibles. Go and tell the world that, my dear friends. I think it's one of the most wonderful, wonderful stories in the whole of the Bible. How that God, through Isaiah, 150 years before, spoke of Cyrus to come. When he did it, like a lamb, he did what God wanted him to do. What more do we need to know about God in control of our world? Thanks.